We'll try to get through the verses. It's one of those passages that in this chapter that there is not a whole lot that can be commented upon, at least with my limited knowledge that I have. I'm sure there's much that could be brought out, but I do not want to conjecture and allegorize and all these things that sometimes people do and spiritualize it to death and make an application that's not there either. So we're turning to Joshua chapter 15. And last time we dealt with Caleb the Conqueror, part 2. And we're going to kind of do a little part 3 on part of this passage and visit Caleb briefly again. But it's centered around the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. And, of course, Caleb was part of that tribe. And some of you may have thought that this evening would be a very entertaining evening as I tried to pronounce all these different names that we have in this text. And I was very tempted to just let Alexander Scorby just read it for you, and it would be a lot easier. But anyway, nonetheless, you'll have to suffer through my southern sophistication or obliteration of the Old Testament Hebrew names tonight. But really, as would be expected, I trust that God's Word is, it's going to be for much learning and admonition. A close-up, as we think of this passage, is really a close-up of the many close-ups that we see in God's Word. We see a lot of close-up of the gifts that God gives in His Word. And this is one of them. This was a gift of an inheritance that God gave to the children of Judah. And sometimes I think that we miss out on some of these, looking at these close-up of these gifts, because we don't take the connection. Some of the things that are mundane or everyday or whatever, things you might take for granted, things that happen day in and day out. I'm reminded that this morning, before or after I wrote this part of the message, I enjoyed a great breakfast. And that it was a gift, a fulfillment. And remember the Father? He gives us in Matthew 6:26. He gives to us, as it says here, "Behold the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns. Yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they?" So that was a fulfillment of that promise. Okay, this is a fulfillment, of course, of the promise we've given Abraham 100 years before. And so we don't always think about these everyday little things that happen to us as really fulfillments of God's promise, details of the gifts that He gives to us. And then we also, I was reminded by Carol, my helpmeet that God has graciously given to me, I was reminded that the garbage cans are full and it's time to go to the dump. And you wouldn't think that that was something to rejoice in a whole lot of, but I just remember that Carol's my helpmeet that God has given to me. And we find that that was a part of the fulfillment of the gift that God has given to me to have a wife like Carol. It's mentioned in Proverbs chapter 19, verse 14. "House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord." That was a fulfillment of that promise. Same holds true, again, with the children of Israel in the promise here. And, you know, when you think about garbage cans being full, is that something that really gets the sermon juices flowing so you can have one of these sermons that just knock your socks off or anything like that? Well, really, when you think about garbage is really an evidence that God has provided over and above our needs. That's what it is, really. It's an evidence that God has provided for us. Not only provided, but provided to where we got stuff left over. So many things we could think of if we would just take the time to think of God's gifts given to us and His promise being fulfilled in our everyday life. And we see those same kinds of things here in our text, in the dividing of the land. It provided for them. It was something that was in an arrangement that gives us the detailed descriptions of the way that all the tribes were going to have their land allotted to them. It was not by something that they were to decide as human beings, but it was by lot. God's sovereignty was involved with the gift. It's like the Spirit of God divides severally as He will the various gifts that He gives to His people. We see that same principle held out here in God's sovereignty. And we see that there is that exact, is such a precision here in these descriptions, so that not only was this a good thing, and not only was it divided up according to as the tribes had need. You know, those who were of greater number got more. Obviously, that would be the good thing to do. And it was by lot, but also it prevented any kind of strife that might occur amongst the people. It's written down and it's all planned out. And we saw again that this was not, this ran contrary to the welfare state that we see pushed in a socialist agenda in our day today. But and again, it also is a preventative measure as far as covetousness, because it was already allotted, it had already been predetermined, and God had required it. And we need to be satisfied on the allotments that God gives us. We find that when the disciples were concerned about who's the greatest and who's going to have the greatest position in heaven, Jesus said in Matthew 20 and verse 23, "To sit at my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father." Something that He had already prepared. It's nothing that we dare not complain about that. Because He is determined. First of all, we don't deserve the gift in the first place. Second of all, God knows what is best. We ought to pray that God would work in us both the will and the do of His own good pleasure. Whether we're talking about who we marry, where we live, the prosperity or lack of it that we may have, we ought to leave it in God's hands. And so now, we want to take in consideration Judah's inheritance, and I call Caleb's AXA. And you'll see what I mean by that in a few minutes. And we want to first look at the Judah's borders. We want to look at Judah's Caleb. We want to look at Judah's cities. And then we see Judah's failures. So we got four things within this chapter we want to attempt to deal with. First of all, in verse 1, it says, "This then was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah by their families, even to the border of Edom, the wilderness of Zin southward, was the uttermost part of the south coast." Now, first of all, we're going to recognize that the first two tribes that are dealt with here are Judah, first of all, and then Joseph, which is really Ephraim and Manasseh. Those are the two most prominent tribes. If you recall, Judah was the one that was blessed because of his association with Joseph and the way that he intervened for him. And we saw also that Joseph got the double portion, Ephraim and Manasseh, and then we also saw that in the process of all that, and because of Reuben's sin, that he had forfeited his birthright as a firstborn. So this is the reason why we have Judah first, and then we have Joseph, the tribe of Joseph, or the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, being involved here as well. We see that the farmland and the water and the defensible areas are all taken into account by our gracious and sovereign God. And we see that Judah and Joseph, their inheritance was divvied up there at Gilgal, where we are presently in our text. But then we find later the other seven tribes. Remember, we've already done the tribes on the other side of Jordan. And then we've already, we'll deal with Joseph, with Ephraim and Manasseh. But we also understand, of course, that Levi did not get an inheritance, as it were, divvied up in the promised land. But the other seven tribes were done at Shiloh. Okay, that's where the next location is, where they divvy up the tribes. And so this assigning again of Judah, the tribe of Judah first, really foreshadowed the preeminence of Judah in the future. Now, so let's look now. We have lined out here in the first few verses the four directions, south, west, east, and the north. That's what we have, all the borders accordingly. And it says, and their south border was from the shore of the Salt Sea, or we call sometimes the Dead Sea, from the bay that looketh southward, and it went out to the south side to Mea-le-Akribim, and passed along to Zin, and ascended up on the south side unto Kadesh Barnea, and passed along to Hezron, and went up to Adar, and fetched a compass for Karkaya, and from thence it passed toward Asmon, and went unto the river of Egypt, and this is the Nile, and the goings out of that coast were at the sea, speaking of the Mediterranean Sea. This shall be your south coast. Now, we find that this is that south border, and now we come to the east border. In verse 5a, very brief description, and this is just like a virtual reality tour as we look at it, all the hills and the bends and all the details here. And the east border was the Salt Sea, or the Dead Sea, even unto the end of Jordan, or the Jordan River. And then we come to the north border. The northern border is the most detailed description of all, as you might expect, because that's where Jerusalem is. Okay? So now it says, and their border in the north quarter was from the bay of the sea at the uttermost part of Jordan, and the border went up to Beth Hogla, and passed along by the north of Beth-Araba, and the border went up to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben, and the border went up toward Debir from the valley of Achor, and so northward looking toward Gilgal, that is before the going up to Adummim, and which is on the south side of the river, and the border passed toward the water of Enshemesh, and the goings out thereof were in Rogel. This is around the Kidron Valley, okay, near Jerusalem. And the border went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom unto the south side of the Jebusite. And this is, again, reiterating what I said earlier, the same is Jerusalem. And the border went up to the top of the mount that lieth before the valley of Hinnom, east westward, which is at the end of the valley of the giants northward. And the border was drawn from the top of the hill unto the fountain of the water of Nephtoah, and went out to the cities of Mount Ephraim, and the border was drawn to Baalah, which is Kirjath-Jearim, and the border compassed from Baalah westward unto Mount Seir, and passed along unto the side of Mount Jearim, which is Cheshalon, on the north side, and went down to Beth Shemesh, and passed on to Timnah, and the border went out unto the side of Ekron northward, and the border was drawn to Sikron, and passed along to Mount Baala, and went out to Jabneel, and the goings out of the border were at the sea. So now we come finally to the west border. Now, by the way, a lot of these names and places, we don't know exactly their exact location at this particular time. We don't know. Many of them we do, many of them we don't. Judah and Jordan, like I said, when I go back home, they change the names and I make new streets and I do all this thing. I go back home and I get lost because there's changes. And of course, obviously there are changes over the centuries. But we see the west border in verse 12 was to the great sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and the coast thereof. This is the coast of the children of Judah round about according to their families. Interesting to note that the word border here is used more times here than any other section in the scripture. And but we find that all these are lined out. Judah enjoyed a land of vineyards. Remember Eshtol? You know, they came with the grapes, the 12 spies. They came from that area. They came from where Caleb was and where Caleb wanted. It wanted to inherit the land that was promised to him. It was a place of vineyards. It was also a place where the throne of David would eventually be established and the Messiah would rule at Shiloh. He would reign. So it was a blessed place, and any place God gives us is a blessed place. It's where we have been put to serve Him and to magnify Him, the particular location that God puts us. But then secondly, we see here in the middle of all this, we come back to Caleb again. We see Judah's Caleb. We've seen Judah's borders, now we see Judah's Caleb, and it says in verse 13, "And unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he gave a part among the children of Judah, according to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua, even the city of Arba, the father of Anak, which city is Hebron." Now, again, because he was of the tribe of Judah, we have him mentioned, and we see more of his reiterating. When God repeats himself, it demands our notice. We find again and in greater detail Caleb's faith in action. Not just talking about it, not just feeling it, not just thinking about it, not just agreeing with it, but his action. He is showing his faith by his works. And so we see that evidenced here. And it says in verse 14, "And Caleb drove thence the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak." Now, this was no easy task. We're talking about giants here. Their names were synonymous with invincible, in a manner of speaking. So that was no easy task, but notice what it says in verse 15. "And he went up thence to the inhabitants of Debir, and the name of Debir before was Kirjath-Sefer." And verse 16, "And Caleb said, he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer and taketh it, to him will I give Aksa, my daughter, to wife." Now what does this say? It says, number one, there was a sense of laxity, I think, that was already setting in. And so he had to provide an incentive for someone to continue on. And so we see that he gives this incentive to drive out the enemy. Now, it wasn't because Caleb was being personally lazy, or afraid, but I believe that in one sense he wasn't desirous to get all the glory and give somebody else an opportunity to be used of God. And we see that also that he was concerned about his daughter. He was not only a fearless warrior, not only was a man of great faith, he was a good father. He knew that it would be somebody who would have to have great faith and courage to attack such a place. And that's the kind of man that he wanted for his daughter. So he was concerned. As I mentioned last week, he was a lot of times we don't think of a rough, tough, and tumble hero as being a family man. But really, it is true. We find it demonstrated very clearly for us here in this text. We see that in verse 17, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it and gave him Aksah, his daughter, to wife. And in other words, the challenge was accepted by his nephew. We have no prohibition in the Old Testament, Mosaic law, of cousins marrying one another. But it's particularly interesting as we look at Othniel and his life. He was one that was the first of the judges. He was the one that took the bull by the horns, if you will, and admirably and valiantly became a deliverer and a judge in Israel. We find that recorded for us in Judges chapter 3 and verse 9. So he was the first person who presided over the nation after Joshua's death. So indeed he was a good man. And Caleb's strategy was one that was profitable and beneficial and wise. But of course, it could be that they were already in love, and he figured that's what Othniel, being the guy that he is, would do. But we see that it's an honor for a man to wed into a good family, and a woman to wed into a good family, and of faith and piety. And we see that is much more desired than just outward appearance or the riches that someone might gain by marrying into family. And I've seen both cases where it just ended up in disaster, because that was the way. They didn't look on the inside. They just looked on the outward things. And it, you know, a pretty face, you know, somebody who might be a sucker for a pretty face or riches or whatever, it's going to, you know, blow up in their face later. But verse 18, it says, and it came to pass, as she came unto him, that she moved him to ask of her father. She's coming up to Othniel, and that she moved him to ask of her father a field. Okay? She was already being the good, submissive wife and having her husband to go up to her father. And she lighted off her ass, and Caleb said unto her, what wouldest thou? So it's interesting that Caleb just went in and addressed her. But notice that she went off of her mount, off of the beast of burden that she was on. That was a sign of respect. You know, when you're on one of those beasts, you're higher than the other person. I was just reading up about dogs the other day, and how that don't ever let your dog get above you. You know, if you're training them, if you're constantly doing that, I guess it's some kind of symbol of being in submission to the dog. Well, this getting off of the beast of burden was a sign of meekness and respect in that day. We see the same thing happened when Rebekah did the same thing when Isaac approached her, ready to honor her father even after she was married. And so all these little things that sometimes we don't notice, we see these character traits in these godly people spelled out for us and give us an encouragement, an example to live by. And so what happens? Who answered? His daughter said, who answered, give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a southland. Give me also springs of water. and he gave her the upper and the nether springs. Now, this doesn't mean that she was being covetous. She didn't ask for silver and gold. She didn't ask for perfume. She didn't ask for jewelry. She didn't ask for a lot of the things that maybe people might ask. But she was more concerned about something practical. Because, you know, if you don't have a necessary amount of water, you won't survive very well. You won't be able to grow crops. You won't be able to fish. You won't be able to do all kinds of things. And so it was a very practical thing for her to ask. And just like our Heavenly Father gives us exceedingly above all that we could ask or think, He gave her not only the upper springs, but the nether springs as well. And like parents too, a lot of times, if we can, we like to abundantly bless our children. But now thirdly, we come to Judah's cities. It says in verse 20, and this is the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Judah according to their families. And the uttermost cities of the tribe of the children of Judah toward the coast of Edom southward were Kabzeel and Eder and Jager and Kina and Dimona and Adada and Kedesh and Hazor and Ithnan and Ziph and Telem and Baaloth and Hazar and Hadata and Kerioth and Hezron, which is Hazor, and Amam, and Shema, and Molada, and Hazar Gada, and Heshmon, and Beth Pelet, and Hazar Shul, and Beersheba, and Bizjathja, and Baala, and Aim, and Azim, and Eltalad, and Chisil, and Horma, and Ziglag, and Madmana, and Sansana, and Lebaoth, and Shilhim, and Aen, and Rimmon. All the cities were 29 with their villages. This is the southern dry plains that we're speaking of here in verses 21 through 32. Then we begin in verse 33. And in the valley, Estael, and Zariah, and Ashna, and Zenoa, and Enganim, and Tapua, and Enam, and Jarmuth, and Adullam, and Soko, and Azekah, and Shearaim, and Adathaim, and Gedera, and Gederathaim, 14 cities with their villages, and this is part of a large section of the western foothills bordering the coastal plain lowland. And now we see in verse 37, Zena and Hadasha and Migdal Gad and Dalian and Mitzpah and Jokthiel and Lachish and Bozkath and Eglon and Kabon and Lamum and Kithlish and Gederoth and Beth Dagon and Naamah and Makeda, 16 cities with their village. Again, still part of that western foothills bordering the coastal plain lowland. Libna and Ether and Ashan and Jiphta and Ashna and Nezib and Keila and Akzib and Marisha, 9 cities with their villages. Again, same area. Ekron with her towns and her villages, from Ekron even into the sea, all that lay near Ashdod with their villages. Ashdod with her towns and her villages. Gaza with her towns and her villages, and the river of Egypt and the great sea and the border thereof. This is the same area, but this is where the Philistines had occupied. And now we come to the part of the central ridge of the hill country, and starting in verse 48, and the mountains of Shamer and Jeter and Soko and Dana and Kirgash-Sana, which is Deber and Anab and Estemah and Anam and Goshen and Holon and Hola and Gilo. 11 cities with their villages. Now we come to the central ridge of the hill country again, Arab and Duma and Eshion and Janum and Beth Tapua and Aphika and Humta and Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, Zai, or 9 cities with their villages. And still the central ridge, hill country, Maon, Carmel, Ziph, and Juta, and Jezreel, and Jokdima, Diam, and Zanoa, Cain, Gilbia, and Timnah, 10 cities with their villages. Continuing on again, the central ridge of the hill country, Hathel, Helhol, Bethzur, Gedor, Meirath, Beth Anoth, El Tikon, 6 cities with their villages, and Kirjath Baal, which is Kirjath Jearim, and Reba, 2 cities with their villages. And now we come to the last part, verses 60 through 62, are the sparsely populated part in the desolate wilderness of the slopes that lead down to the Dead Sea. In the wilderness of Beth Araba, Medan, Sikaka, and Nibshan, and the city of Salt, and in Gedi, 6 cities with their villages. All together with doing a little inclusion and exclusion of the various suburbs, you got about 109 different cities that are mentioned here that were all have their associated water supplies. They also have a farmable land and a defensible position. With all these physical features of the land that Israel had inherited from God, we often forget to apply this as a foreshadowing of our own inheritance. You know, a lot of times we think of leaving this world. We think of, well, I'm going to go to heaven in some kind of spiritual, ethereal plane somewhere floating up on some cloud is the kind of idea mostly that you hear about. And we don't think about the fact that we are going to, what? There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. The physical features, actual real estate that we will inherit and rule and reign with Jesus Christ with physical glorified bodies. And so we kind of miss that. And with this, it really kind of comes more to light what God has prepared for those who love Him because He first loved us. But now, lastly, let's look at Judah's failures in the last verse. As for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem unto this day. At the time of this writing, they still dwelt at Jerusalem. Now understand, Judah had to be a strong tribe and protected by God, because on the east side of their border were the Moabites. On the south side were the Edomites. On the southwest side were the Amalekites. And on the west were the Philistines. So they had, you know, almost surrounded them, except for the north, and that was the other tribes of Israel. So we find that they were in a very vulnerable position. We saw, though, that how in previous chapters how the king of Jerusalem persuaded 4 of his fellow kings to join him to launch an attack, remember, on Gibeon. And in doing so, we saw that Joshua utterly destroyed them and slew the five kings and took all their land. But now we find in Judges chapter 1, verse 8, it says, "Now the children of Israel had fought against Jerusalem and had taken it and smitten it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire." But apparently, a few years later, the Jebusites recovered at least the fort there on the mount. And so, Zion at least, which remained in their hands into the time of David, we can see this as a chastisement upon the children of Israel because they did not go forth and conquer. They were negligent. Maybe they're weary and well-doing. Now, you know, fighting a war is no easy thing, and the fighting. You ever felt like, "I'm just so tired of fighting," and we do get tired, don't we? But we need to continue and not be weary in well-doing, looking to God for our strength, not upon ourselves. And so we need to understand that there's so many things that remain under the control of the enemy that shouldn't be. There's inroads, there's the gates of hell shall not prevail against us. And we need to go forward. We cannot bear to just sit in the pews, but we need to go forward. I was greatly encouraged at the great turnout. 21 of us were there at the park, and who knows what God might have used in all of that. But that's just one way in which, and I hear of you all talking to different people in different places that you go. That's part of going out and possessing our possessions. It's interesting that the city that was destined to be the holy city would not be till later because what happened? It was inhabited by idolaters. And we see that same principle today. We see nations and churches inhabited by idolaters. And God's blessing is withheld on many counts, depending on how bad the situation is. But Israel had everything going for it. Even their enemies were no match for God. And sometimes, however, it's not necessarily the battle without. It's the battle within. The envyings, the jealousies, the fightings, the discontent, the unbelief is what the enemy uses from within. And we become weakened and we fall prey and vulnerable to the enemy as a result. So may God help us. May we realize and put to the test that God can defeat our enemies, whether we're talking about the foes from within or those from without. And may we possess our possessions and go forth and occupy till Jesus returns. Well, we're going to go ahead and close.